Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, no guests, so we can have more time to talk about the issues that are important to all of us, and more time to take more calls. When I was talking the other day about the problems with our liver when we have too much protein from any source and how that creates toxic liver, and then you add in the moderate alcohol consumption, all that is causing what is known as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is virtually an epidemic. In fact, so bad that nearly 70% of Americans who are overweight or obese have it. And that is not a good situation. So nearly 40% of all Americans have it. So I'm going to do a more comprehensive analysis from Kirk Stokoe on natural ways that I've helped people and others are helping people overcome it. So that's good. Also today we're going to take a look at the number of children living amid poverty and how it's increasing, but no one's talking about it. Why the environmental movement is not winning, but what we can do to turn that around. Also, why did the White House refuse to release emails from Monsanto-linked lobbyists? And for those living in New Jersey, let's do something to stop the fluoridation bill over there. You don't want fluoridation. If you read the science on it, you wouldn't want it. Well, one of your own, Deb Huber, has gotten a lot of information out, and we're going to give the numbers and the people you should reach out to in New Jersey to say no to that bill. Also today, the White House is doing what I predict it would. Remember a few weeks ago when Obama set aside acting on that pipeline from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, and I said, don't say this is a victory. It is not. It is merely a political ploy. Look at the language used. Well, today, quote, the White House vows to expedite the new pipeline proposal. So you see, once again, the environmentalists got this wrong. They just don't know who they're dealing with. In any case, there's also a fire called a carbon bomb waiting to be ignited. Scientists are talking about it. The mainstream media is not. Why not? And what you should know about what's going to be happening in the northern parts of the United States and Canada and Russia. Also, Elizabeth Warren, she has a lot of good direction when it comes to keeping an eye on the bankers, but just found out that she also is a major supporter of AIPAC. That's the key arm of the Israeli lobby. And they are openly pushing for a U.S. war on Iran that would likely trigger a global recession. And she supports that. That's unfortunate, so we'll deal with that. Also today, we're going to talk about Monsanto found guilty of chemical poisoning in France. And here's our commentary of the day. Does college make us less equipped to change the world? I'm going to share my thoughts. I'm going to ask you to share yours in return. As you see, we have a lot to share today. All of it important. All of it can give us different perspectives. Let's begin. First up, how would Albert Einstein deal with the idea that today that he would be considered so eccentric, so extreme in his views because he was very anti-authoritarian? Would he accept that he has mental illness and should be put on some form of mind-altering medication? That's exactly what Bruce Levine from Alternet had posited. Here's what he says. In my career as a psychologist, I've talked with hundreds of people previously diagnosed by other professionals with oppositional defiance disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, anxiety disorder, and other psychiatric illnesses, and I'm struck by, one, how many of those diagnosed are essentially anti-authoritarians, and two, how those professionals who have diagnosed them are not. anti-authoritarians question whether an authority is a legitimate one before taking that authority seriously. Evaluating the legitimacy of authorities includes assessing whether or not authorities actually know what they're talking about, are honest, and care about those people who are respecting their authority. And when anti-authoritarians assess an authority to be illegitimate, they challenge and resist that authority, sometimes aggressively and sometimes passively aggressively, sometimes wisely and sometimes not. Some scientists lament how few anti-authoritarians there appear to be in the United States. One reason could be that many natural anti-authoritarians are now psychopathologized and medicated before they achieve political consciousness of society's most oppressive authorities. Now, gaining acceptance into graduate school or medical school and achieving a PhD or an MD and becoming a psychologist or psychiatrist means jumping through many hoops, all of which require much behavioral and attentional compliance with authorities, even those authorities one lacks respect for. The selection and socialization of mental health professionals tends to breed out almost all anti-authoritarians. Degrees and credentials are primarily badges of compliance. Those who extended schooling have lived for many years in a world where one routinely conforms to the demands of authorities. Thus, for many MDs and PhDs, people different from them who reject this attentional and behavioral compliance appear to be from another world, a diagnosable one. I have found that most psychologists and psychiatrists and other mental health professionals are not only extraordinarily compliant with authorities, but also unaware of the magnitude of their obedience. And it also has become clear to me that the anti-authoritarianism of their patients creates enormous anxiety for these professionals, and their anxiety fuels diagnosis and treatments. In graduate school, I discovered that all it took to be labeled as having, quote, issues with authority was not kissing up to the director of clinical training, whose personality was a combination of Donald Trump, Newt Gingrich, and Howard Cosell. When I was told by some faculty that I had, quote, issues with authority, I had mixed feelings about being so labeled. On the one hand, I found it amusing because among the working class kids I had grown up with, I was considered relatively compliant with authorities. After all, I'd done my homework, studied, and received good grades. However, while my new issues with authority label made me grin because I was now being seen as a bad boy, I was also concerned about just what kind of profession I'd entered. Specifically, if somebody such as myself was labeled as having issues with authority, what were they calling the kids I grew up with who paid attention to many things that they cared about but didn't care enough about school to comply there? Well, the answer soon became clear. A 2009 Psychiatric Times article titled ADD and ADHD and ODD, Confronting the Challenges of Disruptive Behavior, reports that, quote, disruptive disorders include attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and oppositional defiance disorder, are the most common mental health problems of children and teenagers. ADHD is defined by poor attention and distractibility, poor self-control and impulsivity, and hyperactivity. ODD, which is oppositional defiance disorder, is defined as a, quote, pattern of negativist, hostile, and defiant behavior without the more serious violations of the basic rights of others that are seen in conduct disorder. And ODD symptoms include often actively defies or refuses to comply with adult requests or rules and argues with adults. Psychologist Russell Barkley, one of the mainstream mental health's leading authorities on ADHD, says that those afflicted with ADHD have deficits in what he calls rule-governed behavior, as they are less responsive to rules of established authorities and less sensitive to positive or negative consequences. Oppositional defiance disorder young people, according to mainstream mental health authorities, also have these so-called deficits in rule-governed behavior, and so it is extremely common for young people to have a dual diagnosis, both ADHD and oppositional defiance disorder. But do we really want to diagnose and medicate everyone with deficits in rule-governed behavior? Albert Einstein as a youth would have likely received an ADHD diagnosis and maybe an ODD as one as well. Einstein didn't pay attention to his teachers, failed his college entrance examinations twice, and had difficulty holding jobs. However, Einstein's biographer, Ronald Clark, asserts that Einstein's problems did not stem from attention deficit, but rather his hatred for authoritarian oppression, discipline in his schools. Einstein said, quote, "The teachers in the elementary schools appeared to me like sergeants in the gymnasium. The teachers were like lieutenants." At age 13, Einstein read Kant's difficult Critique of Pure Reason because he was interested in it. Clark also tells us Einstein refused to prepare himself for his college admissions as a rebellion against his father's unbearable path of a practical profession. After he did enter college, one professor told Einstein, quote, "You have one fault. One can't tell you anything. The very characteristics of Einstein that upset authority so much were exactly the ones that allowed him to excel. By today's standards, Saul Alinsky, the legendary organizer and author of Important Radicals and Rules for Radicals, would have certainly been diagnosed with one or more disruptive disorders. Recalling his childhood, Alinsky said, "I never thought of walking on the grass until I saw a sign saying, 'Keep off the grass.' Then I would stomp all over it." Alinsky also recalls a time when he was 10 or 11 and his rabbi was tutoring him in Hebrew. "One particular day I read three pages in a row without any errors in pronunciation, and suddenly a penny fell on the Bible. Then the next day the rabbi turned up and he told me to start reading, and I wouldn't. I just sat there in silence, refusing to read. He asked me why I was so quiet, and I said, 'This time it's a nickel or nothing.' He threw back his arms and slammed me across the room." Many people with severe anxiety or depression are also anti-authoritarians. Often a major pain in their lives that fuels their anxiety and depression is fear that their contempt for illegitimate authorities will cause them to be financially or socially marginalized. But they fear that compliance with such illegitimate authorities will cause them existential death. I've also spent a great deal of time with people who had, at one time in their lives, had thoughts and behaviors that were so bizarre that they were extremely frightened for their own families and themselves. They were diagnosed with schizophrenia or other psychoses, but have fully recovered and have been, for many years, leading productive lives. Among this population, I have not met one whom I would not consider a major anti-authoritarian. Once recovered, they have learned to channel their anti-authoritarianism into more constructive political ends, including reforming mental health treatment. Many anti-authoritarians who earlier in their lives were diagnosed with mental illness tell me that once they were labeled with a psychiatric diagnosis, they got caught in a dilemma. Authoritarians, by definition, demand unquestioning obedience, and so any resistance to their diagnosis and treatment created enormous anxiety for authoritarian mental health professionals, feeling out of control, labeling them non-compliant with treatment, increased the severity of their diagnosis, and jacked up their medications. This was enraging for these anti-authoritarians, sometimes so much so that they reacted in ways that made them appear even more frightening to their families. There are anti-authoritarians who use psychiatric drugs to help them function, but they often reject psychiatric authorities' explanations for why they have difficulty functioning. It has been my experience that many anti-authoritarians labeled with psychiatric diagnosis usually don't reject all authorities, simply those they've assessed to be illegitimate ones, which just happen to be a great deal of society's authorities. In conclusion, in every generation there will be authorities and anti-authoritarians. While it is unusual in America's history for anti-authoritarians to take the kind of effective action that inspires others to successfully revolt, every once in a while, a Tom Paine, Crazy Horse, Malcolm X come along. So authoritarians financially marginalize those who buck the system. They criminalize anti-authoritarianism. They psychopathologize anti-authoritarians, and they market drugs for their so-called cure. Professor Bruce Levine is clinical psychologist and author of Get Up and Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling Corruption. That leads me in to listening to something from Bill Moyer. I have a great deal of respect for Mr. Moyer. I believe that he is one of the more spiritual and astute anti-authoritarians we have. I also believe that he is proud of his traditional liberal and democratic values. However, I would ask him to reconsider his pro-vaccine position and his pro-authoritarian attacks against those who are being marginalized for not accepting mandatory vaccinations.
We haven't even turned the page on the controversy over contraceptives, health care, and religious freedom when another thorny one comes into play involving personal conscience and public health. A flurry of stories over the past few days caught my eye just after I had watched a movie that inspires more than passing interest in their subject.
Does she have a history of seizures?
No.
Allergies?
Steven Soderbergh's recent film, Contagion, is the most plausible experience of a global pandemic plague you're likely to see until the real thing strikes. Stark, beautiful in its own terrifying way, and all too believable, the story tracks the swift progress of a deadly airborne virus from Hong Kong to Minneapolis, Tokyo to London, from a handful of peanuts to a credit card to the cough of strangers on a subway. Rarely does a film issue such an inescapable invitation to think it could happen. That could be us. What would I do? Perhaps because the movie had invaded my head, for several days I kept coming across stories in the news about contagious disease and the conflict between religious beliefs and immunization. Nothing new here about the basics. All 50 states require some specific vaccinations for kids, yet all of them grant exemptions for medical reasons, say for a child with cancer. Almost all of them grant religious exemptions, and 20 states allow exemptions for personal, moral, or other beliefs. Some parents still fear a link between vaccinations and autism, a possibility science has largely debunked. Some parents just want to be in charge of what's put into their children's bodies. And some parents just don't trust science, period. So you can see there are many loopholes. But now, 7 states are considering legislation to make it even easier for mothers and fathers to spare their children from vaccinations, especially on religious grounds. In Oregon, according to a story by Jennifer Anderson in the Portland Tribune, the number of kindergartners with religious exemptions is up from 3.7% to 5.6% in just 4 years and continuing to rise. This has public health officials clicking their calculators and keeping their eye on what's called herd immunity. A certain number of any population group needs to have been vaccinated to maintain the ability of the whole population, the herd, to resist the spread of a disease. Ms. Anderson offers the example of what in my day was called the German measles, rubella. All it takes are 5 unvaccinated kids in a class of 25 for the herd immunity to break down, creating an opportunity for the disease to spread to younger siblings and to other medically vulnerable people who can't be vaccinated. If you were traveling to Europe between 2009 and 2011, you may remember warnings about the huge outbreak of measles there, brought on by a failure to vaccinate susceptible populations. Here in the U.S., several recent outbreaks of measles have been traced to pockets of unvaccinated children in states that allow personal belief exemptions. The Reuters News Service reports 13 confirmed cases of measles in central Indiana. 2 of them were people who showed up for the Super Bowl in Indianapolis. Patriots and Giants fans back east have been alerted. So far, no news is good news. But this is serious business, made more so by complacency. My generation remembers when measles killed as many as 500 people a year before we started vaccinating against them in 1963. My wife and I both lost grandparents in the great flu pandemic of 1918 that killed as many as 40 million people globally. Our generation was also stalked by smallpox, polio, and whooping cough before there were vaccinations. In a country where few remember those diseases, it's easy to think, what's to worry? But as the movie so forcefully and hauntingly reminds us, the earth is now flat, 7 billion people live on it, and our human herd moves on a conveyor belt of constant mobility. so that a virus can travel as swiftly as a voice from one cell phone to another. When and if a contagion strikes, we can't count on divine intervention to spare us. That's when you want a darn good scientist in a research lab. We'll need all the help we can get from knowledge and her offspring.
I disagree completely, Mr. Moyers. I believe that the entire scientific community is susceptible today of being manipulated. In fact, the largest documented article ever done on the politics and pollution and the disease of science itself for sale will be coming out within the next 10 days. My office and myself are preparing it. But here is the issue. If you promoted proper hygiene, if you promoted for those telephones and doorknobs and handshakes, simple proper washing of the hands or taking alcohol, rubbing alcohol or hydrogen peroxide, you could substantially reduce the infectivity of a person who has either a bacterial or viral infection. The trouble is you're accepting the premise from an authoritarian base, the official base from which all truths emerge in our society, supposedly, that the best and brightest scientists, working with the best and brightest scientific bureaucrats within the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease that oversees our vaccine program, under the umbrella of the National Institute, and protecting the safety of those medications is the FDA and the CDC, that you have somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million people working in public health sciences that are on the ball, whose only interest is the public health. Sir, I challenge you that you're not only wrong in theory, you're wrong in substance, and I shall give you an example of that. Just this. I have testified under oath to a group of scientists and public health officials on their complete lack of knowledge about vaccines and immunity in New York State, and also at the national level. You can see those on my video, and also I've written along with other scholars 19 articles, all completely footnoted, all scientifically verified, from using only mainstream medicine's actual studies that no vaccine has been proven safe or effective for a given person, let alone multiple vaccines. To the contrary, we have shown how absolutely destructive these are to the human body. That, however, has to be compared to the massive public relations job that is being done. No different, I might say, than the job of getting us into weapons of mass destruction, with the entire American media going right along with it. And most Americans are going along with it. The trouble is they were wrong. And how many other times have the mainstream scientific community been wrong? Let me give you one example. Gardasil. The two most popular vaccines being promoted today are Gardasil and the flu vaccine. Fact. Cervical cancer is an extremely low-level incident in the United States, precisely because of the annual Pap screening, which can catch this slow-growing cancer in time to treat it. Further, virtually all women experience human papillomavirus infections throughout their lifetimes, with or without sexual contact, and 90% of all human papillomavirus is clear on their own with no medical intervention. So this is not a vaccine that is even necessary because our previous system had lowered cervical cancer deaths so effectively. The developers of Gardasil vaccine did not attempt to prove that this vaccine prevents cervical cancer. Instead, they used development of abnormal cervical cells as a substitute for cervical cancer based on an unproven hypothesis that the types of cervical dysplasia they chose arbitrarily for their study led to cervical cancer. There is no such proof. Therefore, it is not known whether this vaccine will prevent cervical cancer at all, only that it will prevent certain types of atypical cells, which again are usually cleared by the immune system. Another fact is never mentioned in the media, and that is there is strong evidence that the efficacy of Gardasil is very short-term, so that at 5 years post-vaccination, there is no protection against the four types of human papillomavirus in the vaccine. This contradicts the entire premise for vaccinating girls prior to the age where they are likely to become sexually active, because the vaccine will be ineffective by the time a girl vaccinated at 11 becomes 16. Most importantly, Gardasil has been linked to severe life-altering side effects in many of the girls who have received it, including seizures, loss of cognitive function, loss of ability to walk, autoimmune disorders, and death. The the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System report at least 108 known deaths, but because it has been stated even by a former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration that only about 8% of all adverse effects are ever reported, you could say that there are 92% more, people who've died, and over 24,000 adverse effects. Again, if you do not understand that a person is having an episode because of the vaccine, it won't be properly attributed. So we could really be looking at hundreds of thousands of adverse effects. I've spoken with many of these individuals. I've filmed their mothers. I've interviewed the doctors. Also, what do you say to multiple physicians, board certified in their specialty, all women, who lived in anguish after they personally vaccinated their children develop autism? Well, now they are leading the effort to educate other women and physicians not to accept the official authoritarian rule that vaccines are safe and effective and necessary. But their education came through either the death or the severe injury or autistic behavior in a child. And who are we to believe, Mr. Moyers? Are we to believe the reporters for the New York Times who routinely, almost always, side with the quackbusters as authorities on a particular issue who themselves are completely scientifically bankrupt? Do we look at the people who originate the articles that show us the truth behind the vaccines, behind the politics and the profits? Not at all. We simply take it as a given that if a physician says that something is safe, it must be. It is not. Now to the second issue of the flu vaccine. This is probably one of the greatest frauds ever perpetrated in the history of medicine. First and foremost, just the science is important. Influenza and influenza-like illness are caused by over 200 different viruses, which produce the same symptoms: fever, headache, aches, pains, cough, and runny nose. In the majority of cases, these symptoms only cause mild illness, which resolves on its own after a few days. Most illness identified as the flu is in fact flu-like illness caused by a virus other than influenza. Now, I'm quite sure that you could easily and quickly pull up a public health official record that will say that 36,000 people died last year. But interesting enough, 36,000 people have been dying every year for the last 15 years from the virus that causes the flu. How's that possible? All you have to do is just do actual homework, actual scholarship, and you will see that all their figures are based upon influenza not being due to a virus, but due to pneumonia deaths. So the majority of people dying in the 36,000 are from pneumonia. And as we know, pneumonia and the influenza are two completely different disorders, but they lumped them together. And the media refused to separate them and tell the truth, because if you told the truth, in some years we would have under 400 people dying of the flu, the actual flu. And hence, how could you mandate something going into a person's body that shows such devastating effect? And did you look at the actual studies that verify the flu works? Who did they exclude? Well, they excluded pregnant women, or they excluded women who had been on any anti-cancer medication and high blood pressure medication, any type of psychiatric medication. Well, you're talking about tens of millions of people then who have high blood pressure and heart disease and cancer and depression. But will those same women who've been excluded and men been excluded, now after the test comes in only using healthy young women, will everyone else get the vaccine? The answer is yes. Well, that's completely fraudulent science. If you want a true study, take a group of women who have never been vaccinated, compare them to women who are fully vaccinated, follow them for 5 years on a regular basis and see who's getting the disease and who's not and at what level. It's never been done. The flu vaccine contains three strains of flu virus out of the hundreds that are in circulation at any given time. It is not humanly possible to predict which strain will cause illness, which makes it unlikely that the vaccine will prevent the flu. Repeated studies and meta-analysis done by the independent research group, the Cochrane Collaboration, have shown that the flu vaccine, quote, is not effective at preventing the flu, especially in the elderly and young children. But who is it most advocated for? Young children and the elderly, which are among the main groups targeted. All the package inserts for all flu vaccines, Mr. Moyers, carry the following disclaimer, quote, there have been no controlled clinical studies demonstrating a decrease in influenza disease after vaccination, unquote. For you, sir, I will read it twice. since you seem to be taking on the mantle at this moment of protecting the vaccine industry in your honored position of authority. Quote, there have been no controlled clinical studies demonstrating a degree or decrease in influenza disease after vaccinations, unquote. So the manufacturer's own admission, the flu vaccine is unlikely to work. The flu vaccine has been associated with many adverse effects, including flu-like illness following the vaccine that can last for days, and leading many people to believe they're getting the vaccine caused them to get the flu. Most serious, however, are the other reported adverse effects of the flu vaccine: pain, allergic reactions, anaphylactic shock, Barré syndrome, seizures, myelitis, Bell's palsy, optical neuritis, bronchial neuritis, syncope, thrombocytopenia, and dyspnea, and chest pain and chronic fatigue. Influenza vaccines are full of harmful chemicals, first and foremost of which is the powerful neurotoxin mercury, thimerosal. The majority of flu vaccines, including those given to pregnant women and children, have received 25 micrograms of mercury, which exceeds the safe level on any human being weighing what they would. You'd have to weigh over 550 pounds before your body could even tolerate 25 micrograms of mercury. Other harmful chemicals in your regular vaccine, animal cells, egg protein, ethyl oxalate, an endocrine disruptor, formaldehyde, a neurotoxin, DNA fragments, neomycin and polymyxin, antibiotics, and human carcinogens. That's correct. All of which, in single or combination amounts, can weaken the immune system in addition to causing disease. So here is where we stand. I have had and still have such respect for the issues where you have done your independent homework and provide us with a Joseph Campbell to talk about an issue, or some of the great spiritual leaders to talk about what is lacking in the moral fiber of a country, or why our political system is so corrupt. On this case, sir, of supporting the vaccine makers, of supporting mandatory vaccine, in effect taking a backhand to those of us who have spent a great deal of time in scholarship at the risk of our careers and proven that we are right and they are wrong, I ask you to examine the evidence again, or for the first time. I have 19 articles for your disposal. I have two documentaries, both multi-award-winning documentaries, Autism Made in USA and Vaccine Nation. I will even show you a man who were able to get a new trial and get him out of prison after 7 years for shaken baby syndrome death when he did not do it, and the court finally in a new trial, and I was in that courtroom that day, and showed that every case against him was wrong. How many other people now will get a vaccine because they believe they're doing the right thing because someone of such strong intellectual and moral persuasion as yourself, you are an authoritarian figure in the movement, suggest to do so? You have every right to your opinion, but I would ask you to please examine the facts. And I will send these to you. In fact, today we will email you all 19 articles, all scientifically vetted, all with references, and the documentaries, and my testimony in front under oath, and then also the testimony I gave to the three top medical doctors in New York State, and I wished you could have been in the room to have heard what would be the champions of pro-vaccination when I had a chance, myself against the three of them, with a lawyer and a physician standing by listening to this, to show they knew nothing about vaccines, nothing about immunity, nothing about the science of the cells. And yet they were so pompous, so arrogant, so angry that someone like myself, who is on all levels, in all respects, an anti-authoritarian. I exist solely because I seek to show the truth and the lack of truth in any system, and as a result realize what comes with that. The blowback, the marginalization, the attacks, the ad hominem attacks, and the exclusion. Well, that's fine, because quite frankly, I would never be a part of the Democrat and liberal or conservative and Republican mainstream if I did so. If anyone ever catches me doing any of that, never listen to me again, because I was sold my soul. I'm proud of being an independent thinker, a progressive, spiritual, humanistic soul, willing to take on people, even at times, those who I respect as yourself. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment.
Yeah, shame. Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll and drift away.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'll be taking calls in a moment. I want to go to our issue of the day. Does college make us less equipped to change the world? Boy, this is an anti-contrarian point of view, but it's worth listening to. Also, the Boris Report. Now, I know that today is a political day, and those of you who actually believe that it makes a difference in voting for any of these people, do so. And if you really support Santorum, I'm sure there are those who do, understand his latest quote. Telling a crowd of supporters that the separation of church and state, quote, makes me want to throw up, GOP presidential candidate Rick Santorum today proposed replacing church and state with a new entity called Sturch. Now, merging church and state into Sturch will benefit all Americans except maybe Jews. Mr. Santorum said that the combined entity would offer greater convenience to the American people than the separation of church and state currently does, since Americans would be able to get salvation and motor vehicle renewals at the same place every Sunday. Turning to another campaign theme, Mr. Santorum told the crowd, quote, I support the rights of the unborn child until it's born and wants an education. He contrasted himself with President Obama on the educational issue, stating, quote, Barack Obama speaks in complete sentences. What a snob, unquote. In other campaign news, singer Kid Rock endorsed Mitt Romney, which means that his music is no longer the worst thing about Kid Rock. And an upbeat Mr. Romney visited Daytona 500, where he told a reporter, quote, I love this stuff. I've always been a big NASDAQ fan. I'm Gary Nall. Now, for those of you living on the West Coast, here is the latest. Scientists, quote, used a supercomputer-driven virtual earthquake to explore likely ground-shaking in the magnitude of 9.0 megathrust earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. Peak ground velocities are displayed, and what it shows that it is highly probable in the near future, and it would hit Vancouver, down through Olympia and Portland and Washington, and into California. So here's the issue. It's coming, the big one, equal to or greater than what's going to be happening or what happened in Fukushima. Why don't we pay attention to it and then plan for it? And that's the scientists eyeing that threat. Also, the number of children living in poverty has surged, quote, nearly 8 million children in the United States are living in dire poverty. And that's an increase of almost 2 million in just 10 years. And this is from the Annie Casey Foundation. And here is my thoughts on that. Dire poverty is when they're dirt poor. Many of them are living on the streets. I've been filming them and their stories. You'll see all this starting in June. Poor, where they're living on food stamps and a non-sustainable existence, there's another 8 million. That's 16 million kids where the future's not good. Could you, any of you, tell me what is being done by the White House and this president or members of Congress on either side to change any of the suffering for 16 million kids who had nothing to do with our corrupt political system, the economics, or anything? They just happened to have been born in America. And now they're facing a future as if they were born in a third world country. They're not on anyone's radar. There's no discussion. There's nothing to help them. That's unfortunate. Now to our issue of the day. And, oh, by the way, for those of you who do not have access to the Internet, because I do about 15 hours of live broadcasting a week, and tonight I'll be broadcasting, of course, on our sister station, KPFK, East Coast time from 3 until 9, West Coast noon to, midnight to 6. Different type of show. Lots of fun, lots of and very philosophical. Anyhow, if you'd like to listen to any program over your telephone, write down this number, 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. This way you can listen anytime. And one other program announcement. The showing for the New York premiere, the one-night only showing, it was sold out in minutes, I was told. And not only that, but the whole standing room area and in front of the stage is also done. So please, there's no... I can't squeeze anything in there. It's packed. I'm sorry. But I do have one showing this coming Sunday, world premiere of American Veterans, Discarded and Forgotten. Very powerful film. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes long. And then following that will be a discussion, myself and some veterans I'm bringing in. And then following that is Death by Medicine. So noon, it's American Veterans, 3:15, Death by Medicine. And I'm going to give to everyone who comes some copies of the films so they can give them and pass it on. You get a gift, you share the gift. Pass the information on so our American veterans can at least be helped. Right now, no one's helping them. I mean, you have no idea how bad their situation is, but you will after you watch this film and what we can do about it. This is going to be at the Huntington Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, Long Island. And listeners of this station get a special discount. So call for tickets, 1-800-838-3006. 1-800-838-3006. 1-800-838-3006. This Sunday, noon, American Veterans, Discarded and Forgotten. And that's it for the showings in New York. And then Death by Medicine, 3 o'clock. And that's the last showing of Death by Medicine, which, by the way, just won another film festival today. And then I got to shoot up this Saturday, I think, for 4 hours to... Thank goodness Toronto's nearby because it's in the Toronto Film Festival, International Film Festival. I got to go up, be there for a Q&A afterwards, and then fly right back that night. Now, here's our commentary. And then I'd like you to call in and share your points of view. This is from Sarah Robinson of Alternet. It says, some of the things we learned back at the big university don't work at all on the political street. I'm not going to read the whole thing, just a bit of it here. In this great mediocrity of ours, those of us who've made it through college are encouraged to feel like we're something special. And it's no doubt true that a university education confers certain intellectual, if not economic, advantages. By the time you're handed your BA or BS, you've sharpened your critical thinking skills, have learned to see big pictures, can write a decent essay on command, don't feel lost in a museum, library, or a concert hall, and might even know enough of a second language to navigate the subway and get yourself into the nearest hostel. Furthermore, it's called liberal education these days because generally the more of it you have, the more liberal you tend to be. All good and worthy stuff, but the more time I spend around political progressives, the more convinced I am that when it comes to doing good retail politics, our fancy educations get in the way of almost as often as they help us. Specifically, there are things we picked up back in the old university, biases, preferences, habits of mind, that are so reflexive we long ago lost our awareness of them. But that we're constantly tripping over whenever we try to present our ideas to the rest of the country. It sounds weird and counterintuitive, but in my work with progressive organizations, I've noticed how specific ways in which the kind of thinking we learned in our classrooms actually makes us kind of dumb politically. Here are a few places college graduates often seem to get led astray by their own educations. Originality doesn't matter. In the academy, original thought that adds to the body of human knowledge is the most prized commodity there is. That, and only that, is what they hand out PhDs for. It's also what gets you an A in most classrooms. Your professor doesn't want warmed-over ideas pulled from the book or your classmates or the kids back at the dorm. She wants you to think for yourself, to exercise your brain, to do some original analysis and synthesis, and come up with some fresh insights on the subject. Cribbing ideas from somewhere else is lazy at best. At worst, it's plagiarism and it'll get you kicked out of school. After college, we go forth and become knowledge workers, usually in fields where our ability to think independently is our chief economic asset. Present us with new idea and we'll take it apart. We'll put it back together, mush it up and with other things we know and look for a way to make it our own. Since that's what we've always been rewarded for, that's what we always do. In politics, though, there are times when originality is not an asset. In fact, it can sometimes be a liability. Two examples follow, though there are plenty of others. First, Americans like their politicians to reaffirm comfortable old truths far more than they appreciate being hit with new ideas. The newer and more radical an idea is, the more important it is to swaddle it. A politician who flies too far from the great mass of public opinion risks being seen as flaky, flighty, and generally untrustworthy. In our interactions with family and friends, a lot of us end up in the same position. Because of our intellectual training, we're the smart one who's thinking so far ahead, so fast, that everyone else feels left behind and overwhelmed. On both the personal and the national levels, this mismatch leaves people on both sides feeling uncomfortable and untrusting. Since trust is the basic currency of politics, it's far more important for us to build trust with people than it is to be original, even when we're right. And second, most progressives admire the tremendous message discipline we see coming from the conservative side. They have a handful of designated thinkers who figure out what the message of the day is and how to frame that message within the larger conservative story. Everybody gets the memo, quite literally, and then everybody goes forth and tells the same story using the same language, and they are not afraid to repeat themselves over and over again for as long as it takes. The result is what David Brock called Mighty Wurlitzer, the overwhelming wall of sound that's been reverberating with the same consistent message for 30 years. Their willingness to repeat and echo themselves endlessly enabled them to overwhelm the country's political atmosphere. Until very recently, the noise was so overwhelming, it was almost impossible for progressive voices to be heard through the din. We're in awe of this because we can't do it. And the biggest reason we can't do it is because the originality imperative runs so deeply in our bones. Most of us would gag before we'd repeat someone else's talking points verbatim. Somewhere in the back of our minds, there's still a professor gravely castigating our lazy thinking and threatening to flunk us. We still need to take every new idea we're given, even ideas that have been tested and tried by people far more expert than we are and that work perfectly without any further modification, and mush them around in our heads and make them our own. And we're easily bored by things we've heard before. Can't you find another way to say it? We need to get over this. Nobody will flunk you if you repeat a great argument word for word. And though giving credit is always nice, nobody cares if that new tactic you're using was taken from Occupy Springfield. Out here in the real world, plagiarism isn't a crime. In fact, the willingness to get on the same page and then stay there, singing the same tune over and over for as long as it takes, is absolutely essential if we ever hope to get the kind of control of the national discourse. Your thoughts? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. Your time to call in and share your points of view. Until the phone rings in a moment, we're going to go say hello to Elizabeth, who's sitting here with your emails. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. We've got an article here that discusses there's an effort in Australia to close down the whole alternative health movement, including Chinese medicine, and they're citing the quackbusters and others as experts. But if they were to have done what you've done and independent researchers have done, they would have seen that the quackbusters are not to be trusted at all. We have an article here that was published by independent journalists who took everything that Stephen Barrett was saying was, you know, couldn't be trusted, and they came up with all the scientific evidence that you had also come up with to show that you were absolutely correct in all your subjects like mercury fillings, diet, caffeine, the use of antioxidants, fluoride. I've got pages and pages here of scientific articles that prove that what you have been stating is absolutely correct, and Stephen Barrett has no credibility whatsoever. And just as you said earlier, they've done their actual homework and they've done their actual scholarship, whereas the quackbusters are completely
illegitimate. But here's the point. The point is that the quackbusters work with the official media and the official health reporters to claim that a vitamin's no good or organic doesn't matter, and they're always against those issues, but they don't have science on their side. But instead of a reporter for the New York Times actually doing independent research, they'll call an official institution like the USDA or FDA, totally corrupt organizations that should have been abolished a long time ago, and say, what's the official word on this? Oh, the official word is such and such. Well, that's the same official word that the Quackbuster is using. So then they say, well, I heard it from the Quackbusters. I heard it from the official agency. Then it must be true. And then they report it. Hence, the person that has the truth, the independent physician, scientist, nurse, acupuncturist, journalist, is not going to be given any credibility. You're marginalized out. There's only one truth allowed in the United States, ever. Official truth. If you're not an official truth, you don't exist. The trouble is, almost everything official is wrong. Right. All you have to do is put it to an acid test. As I was talking about the issue with Bill Moyers, I could have done the same thing on AIDS. I could bring you 3,000 scientists, journalists, and multiple Nobel Prize winners, top virologists, will say everything that we know about AIDS is wrong. But then who do you believe? Do you believe the official AIDS community because they've made $800 billion off AIDS with no cures? Or do you believe the scientists who have looked for the truth, found it, and are now anti-authoritarian? If you support a Peter Duisberg, you'll be marginalized. If you suggest that the anti-authoritarian activists are right, your funding dries up and your own credibility. You're no longer allowed in the circle. And being a member of the circle of the known and being a member of that fraternity is more important than the truth.
Right.
But it's also true that we didn't see Rubini. We didn't see Joseph Stiglitz, who knew the truth about our economic collapse. So they were excluded for the most part, and only those who continue to pretend